And so I think that even though she had made a rather clear statement, the fact that she was a female did negate a part of that. I see that that's changing, and of course it's going to change rapidly now. You know that when the Secret Service scan that crowd, they are going to be looking for men and women, and young and old. I think it's not going to matter. Now, we see this through the criminal justice system. I teach at Rutgers University, and I have many police officers in my class. And I have seen a change, and we talk about this in class. You know, what is the attitude of the male officer who comes on a female, and she's in the process of some kind of suspicious behavior or offensive behavior? What does he do? Well, many of them say to me, I just, you know, didn't worry so much about a female. And one of them told me that a woman had pulled out a nail file and used that as a weapon. Another one said that he had been hit in the back of the neck by a woman taking off her high heel. And so both of them told me that now they handcuff women. And I get more and more of this, that police officers are beginning to handcuff women when they find them in some kind of suspicious act, and that they are not. As a matter of fact, the women are changing their attitudes too now, because they are beginning to realize that police officers are being just a little more difficult for them to con, so to speak, you know, when I quote them. There was a time when females would much prefer to meet males all the way through the system. They'd rather meet a male police officer, a male prosecutor, a male judge, because in some way they could manipulate the police officer or judge. They could find something about their femininity would get through to his paternalism. And they would look for this and try to, quote, con or manipulate, yeah, as we say. And the women now, the women offenders, are beginning to realize that it's not as easy for them with the men anymore. They have changed, and so the law enforcement officials are changing. Not as quickly as females are changing, though. Not as quickly as the female behavior is changing. For instance, I also teach judges out at the Judges College in Reno. And I find that it's very difficult for them to realize how women have changed. A couple of years ago, we discussed this problem, and even though I put the numbers on the board, I showed them statistical change, I documented it. They see these women coming through the courtroom. I talked about the change. It was very difficult to convince them that this was actually happening. Females, quote, are not bank robbers, mm-hmm, or females are not auto thieves. Mm-hmm. Females just didn't do those kinds of things. And it was difficult to get this across. And one of the ways to bring this to their, to really drive this fact home, was to bring in female criminals from the Nevada State Penitentiary. These were the girls who explained the change. These were the girls who got through to the judges. These were the girls who talked with them and told them about their assertiveness, aggressive behavior, what they thought they could do. And this is the way we finally talked about the changing female role and behavior.
It's, correct me if I'm wrong, but has it not been a past practice before I guess much of this started happening, that when a woman would act in a criminal manner, it would generally be in a, as you said before, in a, she wouldn't rob a bank, she would maybe shoplift something, or she would become a prostitute. Even so, is it not true that the criminal justice system was set up and is to some extent still set up so that women receive harsher sentences and heavier penalties? You'd think it wouldn't be, but the impression I got was that women actually paid heavier for the crimes that they did commit.
Well, as a result of something called the indeterminate sentence,
right,
that has happened,
right,
that was the problem, and that is changing now. What the indeterminate sentence did was say place the women into a prison for a longer period of time because there were no definite terms stated, no definition of the years, that she would be in an institution until rehabilitated. As a matter of fact, I have read in a number of decisions the words, women are, quote, more amenable to treatment. In other words, if a female, by the fact that she is a female, is more amenable to treatment, then we are going to keep her in prison until she is treated, until she has rehabilitated, because there was something very special about the makeup of a woman. And this is actually in, I've read it in Supreme Court decisions, that there is something different about the makeup of a female, and therefore we can keep her housed, keep her around until she is better, until she is rehabilitated, until she is treated. In that sense, women did get longer sentences than men. I know there were a couple of very famous cases where women and men were involved together, male and female partners, doing the same act, with the male having a long rap sheet, which is an arrest record, mm-hmm. and the female on a first offense, and the female getting a longer sentence because it was indeterminate, and she would actually spend a longer time there. In that sense, the court has been harsher mm-hmm. on the female. I find, though, that it can go either way. It can also be true that there is a more lenient factor involved, and there are some judges, whether it's conscious or subconscious, who say, you know, how can I handle a woman that way? How can I take a mother out of her home? How can I take the wife away? You know, there is leniency based on her femininity, and so she will get a lighter sentence than her male counterpart. My feeling is that too much leniency or too much severity are both wrong, that a case should be judged on the facts of the case, mm-hmm. on the record. The fact that she's a mother certainly enters in as one of the factors, but it's only one factor.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to make it clear that I feel she should be judged on the case and not on her femininity. Because, you know, it may be true that she needs protective custody. She may need some kind of supervision, and she may not be getting it just because of her femininity.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that the court situation, just as I think the corrections situation, needs to be changed. I think that there's much discrimination in corrections,
mm-hmm.
in prisons, in jails. And we can get into that if,
sure.
if you have.
Sure. One of the things that that impressed me about your book was your detailing of the different institutions where women are apt to be incarcerated, and the lack of funds to provide them with rehabilitative services such as they are.
Right. As I travel across the nation and look at the prison situation, it's one where there's blatant discrimination. You can look at the male section and find that the males are being taught many trades, you know, 20 trades available, 30 not, that they're going to take advantage of it. Some will, but
sure.
At least it's available. Training that will afford them an opportunity to, quote, make it on the outside. But then you go across the compound to the other side of the prison, and
mm-hmm.
you see what the women are doing. And you see the women engaged in making flower arrangements, or in learning how to cook, or in learning how to sew, or working in the laundry. Now, how many of the women in prison are going to go home to making flower arrangements and home to a life of just cooking? And now, this is where the discrimination comes in. We are not preparing our women in prison for their problems on the outside. We are not preparing them to support a family in this day, in
mm-hmm.
1975.
Mm-hmm.
So that but really, we shouldn't be surprised when you consider that on any one day in the United States, about 5% of all of those in prison are female. And so by per capita funding, you get 5% of the funds.
Mm-hmm.
Now you need bricks and mortar and uniforms and
right.
and everything else, all the essentials. How much is left over for treatment or rehabilitation? And the women are demanding more.
Mm-hmm.
The women prisoners
mm-hmm.
are demanding more, and I feel that they have a perfect right to. A, I don't think that we need confine many of the women who are now being confined.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we have far too many people in prison. They don't belong there. They don't need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
That we should concentrate on those who need to be in prison, who need the protective custody, and let the others out. There are other types of things they can do, other kinds of sanctions, so that I think tomorrow we could open the doors and probably let 60 or 70% of the women go back to the community, whether it's a non-residential center or whether they go back home. We can make arrangements for a large percentage of the women, and we only need to keep that small percentage housed in our mm-hmm. penitentiaries. And so we can immediately revise the system as far as the females go. But for those who are there, we have to do something. You know, women are beginning to riot in prison. Now, maybe we don't hear about the riots as often as we do about male riots. Many people are surprised when I say that there was a sympathy riot at Alderson Prison during the time of Attica. We never heard about it. Alderson is the federal penitentiary for women.
Mm-hmm.
And we never heard about it. And for several days, the women rioted and wreaked havoc of the penitentiary.
Mm-hmm.
We just didn't hear about it. There was an escape of four women from Niantic, that's the Connecticut prison, where women took a hostage and they broke through the gates and they broke through the barriers of the two state police had set up, or state police of two states.
Mm-hmm.
Were in an accident, they demolished the car, they got out of the car, they hailed a passing motorist, and they took his car at knife point, and they drove on with state troopers from two states following them.
Mm-hmm.
We still didn't read
Mm-mm.
about it. And there's something about what women in prison are doing that's hidden or unimportant,
right.
Or, well, there's so few of them, why should we bother? It's kind of, you know, we don't give enough attention to these women.
Yeah. Part of that problem, I think, is something that was brought out pretty clearly in Chesler's book. She talks about women who are institutionalized for mental problems. And she says that what happens is a woman cannot cope with the pressures of trying to be a female in this society. The pressure to be pretty and the pressure to be loving and kind and so forth and so on, and she internalizes it and goes crazy. They put her into a prison or into a mental institution, which she equates and which I also equate, and she says what happens is, in an attempt to quote-unquote cure this woman, they try to force her to be what drove her crazy in the first place. In other words, she's not considered improving unless she starts taking pains with her appearance and combing her hair and putting on makeup and cleaning her room, and the kinds of jobs she gets are, while she's institutionalized, are mopping floors and doing dishes and making... It's all the same thing. It's all the same thing. It's part of the problem that put her there in the first place.
Exactly, and I do think you mentioned something important, and that is the growing frustrations
mm-hmm.
of females
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
Both young and older people. For the young, it's a matter of a very difficult transitory period. You know, growing up is tough enough.
Mm-hmm.
Just becoming a woman
yes.
is tough.
Yes.
And that's a transition stage. But think of becoming a woman now, in 75. You know, the young girl, she really doesn't know whether to become like her mother would like to be,
right.
or like her grandmother was,
right.
or like her mother is, or maybe like her father.
Yeah.
She really doesn't know which way to go. What kind of role should she take? How aggressive should she be? Should she be a postal clerk? Should she be an airline pilot? What should she do? You know, where should her thoughts be? Should she join the circus? You know, where should she go?
Right.
And then for the middle-aged woman, it's also a very difficult period. Mounting frustrations, because for the woman who is at home, for the woman who is the housewife, we typically have this, we typically have people say to them, okay, what else do you do? And so being a housewife has lost its status. there was a time when you could have importance and status. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs that.
Sure.
By being, you know, a good cook or a good wife or a great mother, good grandmother.
Yeah.
They have all slowly been losing importance and status. And now, for the woman who is at home, out of necessity, raising children or for any other reason, that she can't get a job or that she's not trained, whatever the reason may be, it's a very frustrating time because somehow or other, that life out there, whatever it may be, looks more glamorous, it looks more exciting, and it looks like she's missing something. You know, many women don't realize that, quote, that life out there mm-hmm. is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pressure cooker.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tough to get along day to day.
Right.
You know, to work hard, to be out in the mainstream where there's a lot of pressure. You have to keep up. You have to do the right thing. You have to work hard. It's not easy. But for the person who is at home, for the person who is listening all day to soap operas and who is, you know, waiting for the children to come home from school or playing bridge all day long, for these women, it seems that the women on the outside who are out working have a very glamorous life. This leads to frustrations, and as a result of frustrations, many women turn to alcohol
mm-hmm.
or turn to some kind of drugs. Some in the lower class, whether it's heroin in the lower class or tranquilizers in the middle class or uppers, downers, you know, to turn off or turn on, whichever
right.
way you want to use. But it's all a problem of this mounting frustration in this day when we see kids not knowing how to grow up. And I think this is one of the problems we're seeing with our radicals, with our young radicals, that many of them have a firm commitment to what they're doing. I remember in the late 60s when I was teaching college, I'm still teaching, but I remember what happened in the 60s, when the girls first started to march in the lines, when they first started to be the demonstrators, when they first started to join in with the boys in the anti-war demonstrations, they first started these things to take hold, that females no longer were back painting the signs.
Right.
They were actually marching with them. That females were not in the shadows. They were out there with the boys. And of course, that turned and became someone even more deviant in the, you know, the bomb throwing, the robberies, and the murder situations that some did become involved in. But I think that all of this and these activities, even though on the part of many, there is a real commitment to change,
mm-hmm.
to urban social change. On the part of many others, there is this sense of really not knowing where to go or how to go or what to do. And rebelling has become very difficult. When I was growing up, if I wanted to rebel, and young, you know, youth is a time to rebel.
Sure.
I would take an extra drink, or I would smoke a cigarette, or I would put lipstick on, you know, in front of my father, or I would shorten my skirt, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
there were ways
mm-hmm.
that I could rebel. But these ways don't hold water anymore. Girls are more active politically. They are more involved in the mainstream. They are not at home. Their rebellion doesn't have to be at home anymore, because that's not where they are. They're out on college campuses where the dormitories are co-ed, and they are very much a part of, you know, living together and working together, and the political activities are together. But as far as the radicalized girl, some of them are going too far with this, not being able to find themselves,
mm.
not knowing how to channel something that may be may have a good base. You know, they may be very committed. They just are not sure how to channel it. It is this rebelliousness, which can be healthy at times,
mm-hmm.
but as we've seen lately, it can be also very unhealthy.
It's interesting that you mention alcoholism. I have had some dealings with the military establishment, and one of the things I've noticed is that the military has become very, very concerned in the last, let's say, 10 or 15 years, I guess, with the mounting alcoholism problem among its men. But it is only very, very recently that they have even begun to touch on the more severe alcoholism problem among the women, not only women who are in the military, because those are very few and far between, but among the wives of the men. One of the things that amazed me years ago was at a party that was largely made of composed of people attached to the military, was the amount of alcohol the women drank, and the fact that that some of them drank more than their men did, and that they seemed to hold it better. And I know from experience that this comes only from long practice. Later on, I was able to see that that in fact these women got the practice because they are in a special class. They are left idle over much longer periods of time, especially if it's a new marriage and there aren't children and other things to occupy the time. And it's an incredible problem, and it's so deeply hidden that they're only now starting to deal with it. Now to extrapolate this into the outside world it's going to lead to some very interesting things, I think.
Well, I think that as far as alcoholism goes, you know, in the past, it was hidden because they were female.
Mm-hmm.
That you just didn't put your mother or your sister in an institution for alcoholics.
Right.
It was done, of course, but it was, especially if you were middle class or upper class, it was a very private institution. And you just didn't talk about an alcoholic mother or an alcoholic sister. You kept that really, you know, in the closet. And so culturally, we just did not accept the fact that women could be alcoholics. And yet, I saw many of them. As a matter of fact, I, in the early 1971, I was evaluating drug and alcohol treatment centers
mm-hmm.
for the state of Pennsylvania. And at that time, we didn't have many women involved, but there was a change already beginning. And I think that one of the healthy sides to this this female movement, liberation movement, whatever you want to call it, I don't usually put labels on
yeah.
it, is the idea that we can open ourselves to real problems. We can talk about the female who's an alcoholic, and we can try to get help for her.
Mm-hmm.
She's no longer hidden. I feel that they've been there. I think that these women have been there, and I don't know in what numbers. But the fact that people are saying, oh, women are drinking a lot more now, I'm not so sure that that's true. I think women in the past drank a lot.
Sure.
I think that they're continuing to drink
sure.
a lot. I think that where they drink is changing, but that the amount of drinking is remaining the same. But we are talking about it more. We are seeing it, you know. Culturally, you know, women didn't get drunk and stagger around outside. You know, a woman was taken quietly home and put to bed.
Right.
So that we handled it different. As far as alcoholism goes, the problems are immense. And I'm even happy that you mentioned them, because I think that this is even a greater problem than our drug problem. You know, for so many years, we've heard nothing but drugs, methadone, heroin, and of course methadone, which is an abusive drug.
Right.
We've heard nothing about, we just hear drugs, and we don't hear about alcohol, which is a terrible drug, which is a deadly drug. And this is where a real problem is, because when I was evaluating drug treatment centers, I would go to something called a non-residential facility. This is a place where you go every day and you go home at night. And that's where you're supposed to be drug-free and maintain drug-free that way. And I would always ask the kids, the young people in these centers, you know, what do you do in the evening? Okay, you're off of drugs. Now, what do you do in the evening? Here, you're busy all day long. Oh, they'd say, Dr. Adler, I go home, I put my feet up with a good six-pack.
You know? Yeah.
And that's it. And the evenings were drinking, but drinking or alcohol is really not considered, you know, something not to do, or deviant behavior. If you get yourself a few beers at night, that's fine. You know, as long as you're not popping pills, as long
right.
as you're not shooting up, as long as you're not, you know, doing all of these other things that our culture says, no, no, it's okay to go out and have a few drinks. It's okay, they say, to drink, and, to, you know, here we find the young people drinking beer all night and driving home.
Sure.
Deadly.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I think it's about time we concentrate on real problems. Put the money where our problems lie.
It's so interesting, too, because this brings into mind the fact that the early suffragists who formed the first wave of the feminist movement, this alcohol was one of their prime concerns. And people laugh about it now, you know, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, ha, 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 and beating down the doors of saloons and ho, 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 isn't that absurd and ludicrous and ridiculous? But like all the rest of their ideas, it needs some examination. And when you dig into it deeply enough, you find that they knew what they were talking about. They knew what they were doing. And it would behoove us to, you know, to pay much closer attention to what has gone on before, because it points the way to what's happening now and to what can be done.
Yes, and of course that's true for many things. And I think, especially as we're almost drawing to a close with our female criminality problem, that what you say about looking at the past and looking at the present and talking about what our future may be is even more important. We can look at the past where a couple of names stand out, mm-hmm. like Bonnie from Bonnie and Clyde,
right.
And Ma Barker, and they stand out because they were not typical, they were doing something different. We didn't have girls who were so actively engaged in armed robbery, etc. Then you can look at the changes that have taken place, and you can look at the changes in the 60s with the crime rates changing so rapidly. We've got to take heed, because now we're in the 70s, and the rate of females, the rate of change among females is still going up. And I would say that it's important for us to begin lessening talk about the relationship between female criminality, mm-hmm. and female liberation or emancipation,
mm-hmm.
and look at them as two separate problems. We have on the one hand female liberation, the movement on the part of the women to get up that ladder and move up and have equal rights, and I'm all for that. I think it's great, and women ought to keep fighting for it. That's where they belong. And then over on the other side, we have a crime problem. The fact that 50% of the population is going to have equal rights, and that there's a darker side, and 50% of the population now will have greater potential for criminal behavior, should not make us say, then let's stop those women from equal rights. But it should make us say, let's take a better look at the crime situation generally. Crimes that males commit, that females commit, you know, it's getting more unisexual. Let's just put more money and time into the crime problem and not say, well, if we put women back in the home, that's the solution.
Right.
No, the solution is better reform methods for crime generally, for young and old and male and female, for all of it.
Well said. Thank you very much for being with us. My guest has been Dr. Frieda Adler, who has written a remarkable book called Sisters in Crime. And I thank her very much for joining us. She has been a most articulate and informative guest, one of the best. I'm gonna give her an award later, I think. I want to just remind you again about the Women Office Workers hearing on October 15th at 5:30 at the YWCA on Lexington Avenue and 53rd Street. I want to remind you to listen to the rape program tomorrow night at 10 here on WBAI. I want to thank you very much for joining us. I'm Viv Sutherland. Me here.